Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey. Or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey. PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show.
If you think about the principle of justice, is if you go back in time, Roman law, ancient Roman law is to render each their due. So if you and I make something together and we both put in the same talent, effort, risk, you know, the key factors that you'd want to take into account, yeah, we would split the rewards. You know, that would seem just. And actually, that's how our whole system was meant to work.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools, and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process.
So many people today are looking for value and meaning in their work. And I think you've been listening to the show for any length of time. You know those stats. You know that's the case. And our guest today has incredible insights on how organizations can tackle some of humanity's most meaningful challenges while creating cash flow and business growth. Today, you're going to get some tools to help you embrace your inner genius and become an even better agent of positive change. So our guest today, her name is Melanie Van de Velde, and she used to run Asia Pacific Markets and a multi-billion dollar tech company. That's at a multi-billion dollar tech company. And she worked in senior management at IT startups and then turned her focus to making a difference to the many injustices in our world. And recently, she's written a book based on her experience, on her extensive research and insights. The book is called Lead Like a Genius: How to Outgrow the Competition and Transform Our World. Love that title. So her organization is Big Tree Global Limited, and with Big Tree, Melanie supports business leaders in creating successful impact strategies across the sustainability landscape. Her tools and insights enable companies to create a 200 to 400% better impact return, grow 3 times faster than their competitors, and improve productivity, brand value, and resilience. That's a lot to offer in the 45 minutes or so we've got together today. Welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, Melanie Van de Velde. I'm so glad you're here.
Hi, David. Lovely to join you.
Well, I'm looking forward to learning more about this work and what it means to lead like a genius and all of those elements. But I want to, just so that we can get to know you a little bit better, ask you to take us back to one of your earliest memories as a leader. How far back you go, that's up to you. So I know you talk about a scenario when you were 9 years old that was important to you, but I don't know if that's a leadership memory or not, but where would you go?
Yeah, that is definitely an early memory of I guess, maybe feeling more like my purpose, like, you know, really caring about, like, watching the Ethiopian famine on TV and being really struck as a child by that. And did it give me leadership? Not so much. I mean, actually, I couldn't remember that, but a friend from primary school reminded me that actually I did start up something to fundraise for that at the time. But leadership, I would say my earliest leadership memories. I think it's just kind of my earlier jobs that you mentioned were in a multinational company. So I worked for a lovely company in the south of France. You know, how good does it get? Looking after Asia Pacific markets. So lots of travel, which I loved. A really great company to work for, and I loved it. But from day one, I had a niggle of, you know, if I keep on this path when I'm 85, 90, you know, that kind of rocking chair question, looking back, what has it been for? Like, what's the best I can get? I could maybe get like a VP role in this company, and a brilliant company, but ultimately, very obviously it's about profits. And and for me that was a nickel. I mean, I felt I need to at least have tried to make more of a difference to some of the big issues in our world.
Well, I would definitely say if at 9 years old you were not only asking how can I make a difference, but actively trying to fundraise, even if it's at a 9-year-old level, like I'm trying, that's influencing people to make a difference collectively in some fashion. That certainly sounds like leadership to me, and it's definitely consistent with what you're doing now.
Yeah, I guess so. And isn't that lovely when you think back about childhood memories? Because I think that's when you're most pure. And I guess we all, well, most of us, I think, get to a stage in life where it's really easy to be drawn into wanting security. I think particularly, when you think about having a family, it's easy to get drawn away, I think, from maybe your kind of inner. Yeah, maybe your inner purpose, like the other important things, and I think there's a balance. I think being secure, financially secure, is I have had to also learn that, and it kind of at some point in my life that is also very important. But I think staying true to who you really are, it is good to sometimes make those dots back to childhood. I think so.
Yeah, there's those elements. I ask every guest that we talk with that question as we get to know you, and it is it's fascinating to me. I'd say about 85% of the time there is a through line from one of those earliest leadership memories from maybe it's childhood, adolescent years, that still is a driving force in their leadership today. So it's always fun to learn.
I would be curious to ask you what yours is, because I
Oh,
don't know
if I
if we can go there.
if I absolutely can. I have two that both go back to when I was 11 years old. And one of them is positive and the other not so much. The positive one was I was the oldest of six children, and so a large family, and there was this day in the backyard of our house where everybody had their friends over, so in different age groups. And everybody was doing something. There was a little wading pool that some of the younger kids were splashing around in. My friends and I were throwing a frisbee in a triangle around the yard. My middle sisters were playing on the jungle gym swing set, and somebody else had some toy animals that was happening. And it's like this gong. It just like the motes of dust suspend in the air, and it's like time stops for just a moment. It was a weird experience to have when I was 11. But it was this feeling of, wow, I helped make all this happen. And the harmony with which it was all happening felt amazing. It was one of those moments that was like, whoa, that is so cool. So for me, that's one of the earliest kind of positive moments, like, wow, that I didn't identify it, as you said, I didn't identify that as leadership back then. But as an adult, I look back and I go, no, that's it was ringing that gong of part of that, what I enjoy and what motivates me. Yeah.
Lovely.
So I've talked in the show about one of the less positive ones in the past where my dad left me in charge of getting the house clean, and my solution to that was to lock everybody in the basement until they got the basement clean. So yeah, that I had some things to learn when I was 11. All right. Well, I was
We learn from those also, don't we? Sometimes.
that. Well, hopefully we do. Yeah. My sisters learned to lock me in the closet from there on. But so I was not in that moment leading like a genius, which is our goal today, is to learn more about that. And one of the big ideas that you have, Melanie, is that as human beings, that yes, we are wired to survive and pursue self-interest, and that is part of who we are, but we have this inherent nature to look after each other, and that businesses often ignore that part of our nature, and that's a mistake. Tell us more about that.
Exactly. I love that concept. It actually is a bit the red thread underneath so much of the book. And I think it's a lot about us as humans. I think it's also about how we do business or our economic system. And I think it's the essence of it all. Like you say, we are wired, to have some level of selfish interest, look after ourselves, survive. But like you say, I mean, psychological studies actually show it that if we do that to the detriment of others, it actually affects our own mental and physical health. We are really wired to, look after each other and be stronger as groups. And so I think that's really interesting research and also a lovely story. I don't know if you've read this book by Rutger Bregman, who talks really about that kind of most of us are good. Most people are good. And he really tried to find the actual Lord of the Flies. Do you know that book, Lord of the
Oh,
Flies?
yes. Oh,
Yeah,
yes.
exactly. And I think it has formed so many people's opinions of, right, okay, that's what happens indeed, when we're just left to it, and particularly children, we just look out for ourselves and we can be, pretty mean to each other. And he went to find the actual Lord of the Flies. So he found there's a group of boys that actually, like from the age, I think between 11 and 15, if I remember it well, who stole a boat at secondary school and went sailing, ended up in a storm, ended up on an island for a year and a half. And they actually survived and looked after each other incredibly well to survive that whole period. And so, yeah, it's a good realization, I think, that we are much more caring and much less selfish than I think many of us believe, have been taught to believe. But also, I think the system that we have created is more wired, I think, to lean much more to that kind of self-interest. And I think that's where we have created a lot of issues that, yeah, I think is really important for our future to rebalance.
I'm remembering a literature teacher that I had who, when he was teaching us Lord of the Flies, one day we all arrived for class and he's not in the room. And the desks are in complete disarray. And so we go in, and a few of us start straightening the desks and take our seats, and others leave their desk a little cattywampus, and we start having conversations and so on. And about 15 minutes later, he comes into class, and he just wanted to see what would happen. Would we go Lord of the Flies, left to our own devices? I said, I don't think that worked out. I mean, fortunately, it didn't. I don't imagine he'd still have a job if it had. But, that's such an important point you're making about the tendency we have, the how important that is to our psychological, emotional well-being. So, what are the ramifications of this for business, do you think? And what led you to write this book the way that you did, as you look at all of this?
That was more a kind of end point. That wasn't so much the starting point. My starting point was very much I made my own kind of journey to search for, right, okay, business background, but I'd really like to make a difference. What can I do, with my background? And can I actually do anything that's meaningful, that really kind of helps people? And what is that? And I ended up ultimately running programs in the Kibera slum in Nairobi. It's one of the biggest slums in the world, over 1 million people who on average only live to 30 years old. So you can imagine what that means. It's a lot of children, a lot of young people, not many parents, so lots of orphans. And we had a range of programs we provided, so orphans, part orphans with school uniforms, school fees, food programs, so they could stay with other families in the slum as opposed to being institutionalized in orphanages. So more kind of traditional charity. And I think charity is very important, but it's often alleviating symptoms. And we also had programs for young women where we provided training and employment opportunities. And that opened my eyes to, like, wow, not only can businesses do something, but and that's what I've realized now across the board, actually, across our key global issues. I can now see so clearly how businesses actually hold the key to solve many of our global issues. So for me, it was really that journey of understanding what can we do and how can we do it well. And my research was all very much around, well, there are some amazing companies and initiatives that have very good success rates. But then there are so many that have very good intentions. And actually, if you're trying to empower people from disadvantaged backgrounds, some have like an 80 to 90% success rate, do commercially really well, but many others have like a 20% success rate. And why is that? And so it was more that. But ultimately, then that led me to also see it from the other side. which is very much what we're actually missing in how we're doing business and the concept, and actually that a lot of these global issues have been also caused by how we do things. And it's sometimes hard to see because the links aren't often so clear. An example, just to make it less abstract. So I think a good one to talk about sometimes is, like, most of us are quite familiar with climate change and things like that, but the plastics issue maybe a bit less so. And so if you look at the kind of key statistics, and the research, it shows that by 2050, unless we change things around, there will be more plastic in our oceans than fish if you measure it by weight. So that, I think, really visualizes how huge that problem is becoming. And that's obviously terrible for the biodiversity in our oceans, but it's also impacting our health. So we now, on average, eat, drink, and breathe 5 grams of microplastic. And scientists are looking into how's that affecting us. And there's links with even, you know, the impact on our DNA, on our gut, but also illnesses such as cancer. And you don't easily think that the use of plastic is linked to, you know, we all know people who in our lives who have cancer. And the same with air pollution, is what 90% of us in cities globally breathe unsafe air. And it's one of the major causes of lung cancer in the world. And so the links aren't always so clear, but once we know the links and once we think about, right, these are the issues, how can we actually solve them most effectively? And look at the examples around the world that have, you know, have done this and have successful ways of dealing with it. And it suddenly, I think, it can open your eyes to how much you can actually make a difference. And that is not like a short-term, you know, like temporary solution, but really, really can help us. If all business leaders did that, I think would genuinely give us such a much better future. Yeah.
And that brings us to your book, Lead Like a Genius, How to Outgrow the Competition and Transform Our World. And our guest today joining us from Glasgow, Scotland, is Melanie van de Velde, and you're the author of Lead Like a Genius, obviously. So let's talk about this concept of making this difference and through business and with our business objectives. But I want to start with, when you say lead like a genius, what is it? What do you mean by genius? What does that term mean to you in this context?
So it's interesting. It comes from a piece of research by Albert Rotherberg at Harvard in 1979, who wanted to understand why geniuses were so exceptional. You know, there were all other very kind of clever, very talented people of their time. What made them stand out? And he found that they had one common trait, and it is the pursuit of the unity of opposites. And so, for example, Einstein played with objects that were both at motion and at rest. Picasso created images that conveyed both light and dark. And so that kind of yin and yang is something that Eastern philosophies already pointed towards, like, is a really kind of life lesson, I guess, so important. And increasingly scientists and also management scientists are pointing to exactly that. And they call it paradox theory, that the solution to many complex issues is exactly that. It's the pursuit of the unity of opposites. And the reason why it's so unique for people to do that is because our brain isn't wired that way. So our brain is wired that when we see opposites, we want to look at predominantly one or the other. And I think that is the thing also with business. It's like, if you talk about profits and purpose, or profits and value for society, or call it whatever you like, it's often perceived as two opposites. And we struggle with that. So we either see a profit-driven business, and it's okay for them to have a secondary, you know, charitable way of thinking, or some level of sustainability, but it's not an integrated whole. And what sometimes blows my mind even more is that if you then talk about, like, a social enterprise or an impact enterprise that is set up to do good, but uses, you know, commercial activities to support that, that it's almost not okay anymore to make money. So, you know, you see that, like, if let's say you're a CEO of a cafe, that is super sustainable and provides opportunities to refugees, for example. For that person to make a huge profit, people maybe just start asking some questions. Whereas the owner of the cafe next door, might actually have a lot of plastic pollution, might not be, paying staff fairly, whatever. And then it's almost a plaudit to make a profit. It's kind of weird, isn't it? But it's really coming from there. And so when I then looked at the most successful initiatives in the world that really have those, excellent success rates, a Tony's Chocolonely from the Netherlands, who are growing incredibly fast as into a global successful brand, and tackle child slavery, poverty in West Africa, where most of our world's cocoa is produced. They do both things really well as an integrated whole. They pursue profits. They don't forget, really emphasizing the commercial value of their product. So it's great chocolate, really well packaged. It's not like a fair trade brand that you buy because, okay, it's fair trade, but actually don't really like the chocolate. But it's both. And so it's really that I found was the underlying red thread between the most successful examples. They managed to integrate profits and having that purpose of creating a better world as part of a whole.
So, all right. So, when we're talking about leading like a genius, it is that pursuit of the unity of opposites. It's the research phrasing of that. Well, around here, we at Let's Grow Leaders, we call it land in the and as a way to think about that, as when we're
Okay.
stuck between those two things that seem to be opposite of one another,
Yeah.
business results, relationships with our team, like showing up with confidence, showing up with humility. Like it's not an either or. How do we
Yeah.
unify? How do we land in the and all those kinds of things? And so this one is one of those of how do we pursue the business profitability and the impact, the positive impact on our world and other human beings.
Yeah.
All right. So at the core of your model in Lead Like a Genius is something you call the impact wheel. And so this is a visual model, and I know we're in an audio forum. That's okay. Can you describe for us kind of those core aspects of the impact wheel? And then we'll kind of walk through that a little bit and think about what that can look like for leaders who are trying to do this pursuit of the unity of opposites.
Yeah. So that's the thing, because we talk quite, I guess, like the underlying principles, and it might sound a little bit abstract, but actually you can really simplify it. And that's what I've tried with the book is really like, look, here are the examples. This is the framework, the impact wheel. These are the questions you can ask to really practically start doing this yourself. And the impact wheel, I guess good to just maybe explain it a little bit, why those four areas. So the impact wheel is indeed, it's three circles. What can you do as part of your company, as part of your supply chain, and as part of a wider context in four key areas? And why those four key areas? Well, my starting point was very much the key global issues. And I think a good place to start is the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. The key kind of to-do list for humanity as the UN has defined it. So it has things like number one, zero poverty, number two, no hunger, number three, good health and well-being. And so we have 17 goals. And what I find with a lot of leaders is that it can be a bit overwhelming. 17 goals, and they have all these sub-goals, and
Even
what do I do?
just one of those goals is overwhelming.
You're right. It is like that's exactly what I found. So when I was in my role in the company in South of France and Asia Pacific, seeing the poverty out in the streets, India was one of the markets I looked after. It's like, what can I do? And you want to make donations, and you kind of know that, right, okay, that might alleviate their symptoms for a little while. But I know it's not going to really fix poverty. I know it's a short-term thing. And if anything, sometimes charity, when it's used longer term, it can also do more harm than good. When the secondhand clothing donation started in or ramped up in Africa, over 50% of the people in the local textile industries lost their job as a consequence. I mean, I witnessed myself in the slum. Charity can be absolutely vital, but I love the analogy, and this is what the impact wheel is about. I love the analogy of imagine that you're running a nice warm bath and you walk away, you take a phone call, and by the time you come back into the bathroom, the floor is covered in water, the bath has started to overflow. So what would you do? Like literally nobody would, you would turn, you were going to say turn off the tap, right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. That's what everyone would do. You turn off the tap or you pull the plug. Nobody would think, let's mop up the floor, but leave that tap running and leave the situation as it is and don't tackle the cause, the root cause of the issue. And that's exactly what we do a lot. We deal with the symptoms of poverty, of the mountains of plastic, you know, accumulating in the rivers. We can scoop up plastic from the oceans, but unless we stop the plastic from coming, it's a losing battle. And so that was the thing for me. It's much more effective if you tackle the root cause of the issue. And interestingly, businesses are so well placed to tackle the issues. And if you look across the 17 SDGs, so let's say you look at the first few, they're pretty much all kind of poverty related. So if you look at the first six, so as opposed to what you see a lot is that companies look at those and they're like, right, okay, we need to do something about all of them or quite a few of them, right? We need to SDG 2, let's do something about hunger. So Preza Manje, let's donate leftover food to the homeless, for example. Or, you know, Warby Parker, let's donate a pair of glasses to someone in need. Or Tom's Shoes, let's donate a pair of shoes to a child in need. And if you then look at Soul Rebels, and I think that shows the kind of really different approach of what's possible, she has opened up manufacturing facilities. She's an Ethiopian businesswoman in areas that really need economic development. And she's created this company called Soul Rebels, which is one of Africa's fastest growing footwear brands. And she pays her workers over three times the industry average wage. And I love how she puts it. She says, if you give a child a pair of shoes and it grows out of it or it wears out of it, then what does it have? But if you give parents a job, the whole family will always have shoes. And that's so true. And who can create jobs? You know, it's business leaders. And that's the thing, is it's like sometimes also businesses will say, well, so actually we are already doing something really good. And yeah, if you're creating jobs and you're paying people fairly, you know, according to their contribution, doesn't mean everyone the same, but you know, it's fairly done, you pay your suppliers fairly, you are making a difference. And you can take that further. And so you can, like, Soul Rebels is obviously like, right, who can open up manufacturing facilities in Ethiopia? Not everyone, but you have other amazing examples of Goodwill Solutions is a logistics and warehousing company in England. They are also doing it really well, the commercial side and the impact side, you know, which is helping them grow very fast. So you see also that companies that are really good with the impact, they get more customer referrals, you know, they get customer loyalty more. So they tend to grow faster. They're one of the FTSE fastest growing companies, and they offer opportunities in kind of more deprived areas in England. So people who've been out of work, for example, you know, youth who've been long time unemployed, you know, that kind of thing, or people who've been in prison, or giving them a second chance, but again, doing it really well, you know, making sure it's really good service and these kind of things. So the impact wheel is actually taking four areas where companies can tackle the root cause of the 17 SDGs most effectively. And it really simplifies things. And then there's different questions you can ask. There's every business is different. Everyone is an expert in their own business. But if you go through the examples, you go through the questions, I think most leaders will be surprised at how much impact they can actually have. And by tackling the root cause in those four areas, you don't just create more structural outcomes. So if you think about Soul Rebels, they don't just tackle poverty longer term, but that has knock-on effects on zero hunger, on health and well-being. So it creates synergies across the SDGs.
Absolutely. And so as we think about having this kind of impact and looking, and what you said about root causes is so important. I come from a in the United States, a nonprofit NGO background. That was 17 years in that industry. And so I've definitely seen so many of the impacts you're talking about of the organizations that are in that space that people feel good about what they're doing, but the impact is not as positive as they would hope, or often sometimes even destructive over time for unintended consequences. And then there are others that really are able to do a much better job of getting to root cause and getting to sustainability and true fashion. So as we are thinking about our work, listening right now, thinking about what we're doing, I'd like to have you outline for us these four aspects of the impact wheel. You took us through the concentric circles that kind of make up the wheel. Now there are these four elements and what those look like. And so let's go through those. And then I want to try to get practical and think about from a leadership perspective, wherever we might be. Like you said, I might not be able to open a shoe manufacturing facility and employ people in Ethiopia, but there is always something that we can do. So let's start with the wheel and then we'll go there.
Sometimes I find it hard to go through the wheel in a short space of time because I worry sometimes it makes it sound so restrictive because there are so many different ways you can go with it, but it will illustrate it at least. Yeah, I guess so.
And partly we want people to buy Lead Like a Genius to read it and really see. I mean, if you read the reviews on this book, listener, people are like, you have got to dig your hands into this. It's better than just about any program you could take. I mean, it's to really learn the depth of how to make a difference and pursue that unity of opposites that Melanie's been describing to us. So, okay, Melanie, back to you. Let's talk about these four quadrants.
Yeah, I'll try and make it as simple as possible and also use some examples. So the top half of the wheel is all related, the two areas, to poverty and inequality related issues. And so the two ways businesses can tackle that kind of really root cause is by empowerment. And it's not necessarily the same as social inclusion, but it's really actively empowering people to contribute their best potential. So if we did that and we also would think more about what are the areas around us, the people around us that, you know, maybe really need an extra opportunity, they are more disadvantaged, and it could be people who have a disability, for example. And I'll give you a lovely example of that. In the Netherlands, there's a company called Sea Talents, and they work with people who are blind and deaf. And like in most other countries, in the Netherlands, about 70% of people with a hearing or visual impairment are unemployed. And have kind of always been getting that message of, you're not really employable. And sometimes also, often they have real lack of kind of confidence, self-belief. And sometimes because of really good intentions of people around them. So, you know, people would have like, okay, my son, daughter is blind, so I'll always drive them to their friends. You know, they can't go by themselves. So anyway, this businesswoman, Sandra Bali, who is such an amazing woman, she first of all set up a restaurant called Sea Taste, which is dining in the dark. And she recruited waiters who were blind. And she told them, if you want to work here, your parents cannot bring you here, but you download an app, so many steps to the bus stop, you know, you take the bus, you know, you make your own way to the restaurant. You can do this. And, you know, bit by bit, their whole confidence, self-belief changed. Hey, I can do this. I can hold a job down. And actually, I can go out and I meet a girlfriend. And their lives completely is an upward spiral. So really, really inspirational. And she then realized, hey, most of my waiters are completely overqualified. They have studied marketing, they've studied accounting, and they're super bright. And on top of that, she also realized that, hey, there is a phenomenon called neuroplasticity. People who are blind have become better listeners because the brain rewires itself. And people who are deaf have a much better eye for detail. Hey, and she was an investment banker, very commercial thinking, very much leads like a genius. And so she was very much thinking, hey, where can that commercial value come in handy? So she started working with companies, trying to tell them, and they'd be like, oh, well, you know, our first meetings were very much along the lines of, we have a cleaner position, or my colleague needs a stagiaire, like not really valuing people and their talents. So she said, no way. Like, I've got a super talented marketeer here. And so she managed to convince companies to take some of these people on, supported them with like some of the tools that needed to be in place. And occasionally it also meant just reinventing the jobs a little bit. What are the things that someone can do who's blind? What their colleague can maybe do? And it led to a lot of benefits, not just these individuals who were extremely motivated because they'd been, you know, sitting at home, been given a chance, you know, doing extremely well, bringing additional talents also. But also they noticed that people in the team started to feel more motivated. If my colleague who's blind is turning up for work, I'm not going to sit at home when I have a cold, you know. And so they became more productive. They became proud of where they were working. And because she did that combination so well of the commercial value and really empowering people. So I think that's what I'm trying to highlight. It's the empowerment piece. Companies came back like a year later. Do you have another one? This is so going so well for my, you know, for my business. And her company is growing revenue, like doubles their revenue each year. Their impact is growing. So it's a real success case. And most companies could employ someone who comes maybe from a more disadvantaged background and or several people, you know, and maybe work. You can also work with companies who are specialized in this. You have them in different areas, you know, whether it is, you know, other types of disadvantages. It can be in your supply chain that you empower people more. So Coca-Cola does it, for example, you know, with mothers across the supply chain. And so there's different ways of empowering. And then the second part of that is really what I've called just payments. I find this always the most challenging because we are so conditioned. That this is almost, I think, when I talk about this, sometimes I think, you know, does she live in a pink bubble?
let's pause for just a moment. So the first quadrant we've just talked about is empowerment. And so you, in your definition of empowerment, the way that you're thinking about empowerment is creating opportunities to let people step into all of their potential and power who maybe not otherwise are not having those opportunities.
That's nice.
So that's partly employees, it might be people in the supply chain. There's lots of, and that's part of what you were saying, you don't want this to be restrained or constricted in a narrow definition. There's so many different opportunities. And that's, again, that polarity of opposites. Like, what are all of those different ways we might be thinking about that, of where we can allow that to happen? So do I have that right just before we move on?
Absolutely right. Yeah. And that's the thing is it's there are so many ways to empower and different types of groups, different types of areas you can think of. So that's why I think it's good. Look at a range of examples from around the world. And yeah, and I think sometimes, so if you're like maybe a practical thing, what can you then do? But not just in this area, across all four, is you can do, like, you can even brainstorm with teams, you know, in your company, and people will have a range of ideas of, you know, this, and this really fits with our DNA of our culture. You know, we could do actually something along those lines. We could create empowerment opportunities, you know, within the company, supply chain, or a wider context. And yeah.
And even that is an act of empowerment with your own team or your colleagues of
in
creating ownership of those things. We all have this power to make this difference if we can think about it and talk about it together. Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. So that's empowerment. And then let's move on. You were talking just payments.
Just payments. Yeah.
Just, so actually, not just as in only payments or dismissive payments, just as in justice.
Justice payments.
Just payments. Yes.
Yeah. And on purpose, it doesn't say fair payments, because to me, it has the connotation with fair trade, and fair trade is very much still kind of bottom line. So if you think about the principle of justice, is if you go back in time, Roman law, ancient Roman law is to render each their due. So if you and I make something together and we both put in the same talent, effort, risk, you know, the key factors that you'd want to take into account. Yeah, we would split the rewards. You know, that would seem just. And the thing is that actually that's how our whole system was meant to work. So Adam Smith, father of free market economies, that's what he said. Like, if we want to have free market economies and have free trade, the only way this can actually work is with strong principles of justice. And I think that's the thing that we haven't done, and I think it's caused so many of the issues. And so if you look then over like the last few decades, it's happened across supply chains. So where like most supermarkets hold most of the power in supply chains, you see that like, you know, banana farmers typically get 4% for growing and harvesting the fruits. Dairy farmers in the UK, I don't know if this is the same in the US, tend to really struggle. They can't do an awful lot. If supermarkets say, look, the prices are coming down, they're coming down. And, you know, you might go out of business. Yeah, you know, it's not the supermarket's problem. And so the thing is, the principle, the moral, the kind of legal principle is that power is not unlawful, but the abuse of power is. And I think we have over time, and it's the same. I've studied business. I've worked in business. We have become quite used to thinking that actually driving prices down, supplier prices or wages for people at the bottom, you know, it increases profits. And it's just been a gradual process. But if you then look at what's happened over the last kind of 4 or 5 decades, is that, for example, the CEO to average worker pay gap used to be about 1 to 20 something, and it's now 1 to over 400. Mm-hmm. So that's huge. And if you then look at, you know, inequality, has that's been rising, it's one of the major causes of inequality. And that is affecting all of us. It's, you know, the more unequal societies are, mental and physical health goes down across the board. Productivity actually goes down also of countries. It's creating more polarized societies, more social unrest, more populism. And it's quite scary to think, you know, when it happens so gradual, we're not really seeing it, but we're kind of at similar levels of pre-Second World War. So I think it's a big issue in society. And also, it's not necessary, and it's not even so good for business either necessarily. And so anyhow, if you look at, for example, companies that do this well, like a Tony Chocolonely, who've started paying a lot more to their cocoa suppliers in West Africa, it's more expensive. Their products are more expensive, but they're doing extremely well as a business. Hisby Supermarkets, they are paying 67 pence out of each pound to their suppliers. And, you know, when you buy anything in the supermarket, it shows it on the receipt. And so, yeah, you see more and more companies, particularly some countries around the world, trying to kind of change that balance. So there's different, again, there's different models, different examples of companies that do this well. I think it can be a challenging area for companies to change the way of thinking around this. Sometimes companies go down the more kind of employee ownership kind of model. And what's really interesting there is, you know, kind of as we started off our conversation, if you look at, for example, John Lewis, Mondragon in Spain, who do that, and it's more employee owned, the people across the company actually even have longer life expectancy. So it is ultimately, yeah, it can be a really good thing commercially. If you look at the Costco versus Walmart, for example, you know, Costco has a much lower pay gap ratio, does a lot better than Walmart on many, many kind of factors. So that is what I mean by just payments.
So let's, as you're describing that, kind of that assumption that pushing down costs, whether those are labor costs, manufacturing costs, whatever, that is inherently good as it increases profits. And I was reminded as you were describing that conundrum of Seth Godin, and the way that he says it is, the problem with the race to the bottom is that you might win. And I like that way of thinking about that, is that there is this destructive consequence at the end of that race if we don't extract ourselves from that. And so when you're talking about just payments, that is a way to remove ourselves from that particular carousel or whirlpool or wherever it goes down. So I want to ask you, if you could, for just a moment, as we're thinking about, we kind of got the general concept, but when I'm thinking about whatever business I'm in, if I want to start operating on this principle of just payments, and whatever, maybe I'm a Maybe I own a pizza parlor. Maybe you mentioned grocery stores and supermarkets and so forth, but there's so many different kinds of businesses that people are in. So if I'm thinking about just payments, what's a question or a way that I can start to think about that that helps me to look at how I'm doing business, the questions I can be asking, and then to take action on those?
So the book outlines kind of all the different examples, but also the questions as part of, you know, what you can do in-house, again, supply chain, wider context. So it does indeed really depend on the type of business that you are. But if you were a pizza parlor, I guess, you know, the first thing is probably more around staff. And I think that's comparable to like a big Costco, for example. If you're going to be the different restaurant who's paying their staff quite a lot more compared to an average restaurant, you'll most likely find that you're going to be able to attract the best waiters, the best staff, which is going to have a big impact on your service. And that's exactly what happens at Costco. So they have, they're growing really fast. They're doing really well in terms of profit figures, revenue figures, stock figures also, and it's really down to their customer retention rate, which is exceptionally high, which they explain by having staff who are happier. You know, they're happier, it's a better customer service level, and so that can have a huge positive impact on your business. So I would think in that particular context, but similarly, you know, for them it would be interesting to look at their suppliers, you know, what kind of ingredients are they sourcing. And obviously then the other areas of the wheel are coming in also from a kind of climate side, you know, is it locally sourced and things like that. But then how do you pay? You know, is it a fair price, or are you, you know, if you're negotiating prices down to the extent that your suppliers are really struggling, maybe then there's something wrong in that supply chain, and the prices of the final product just can't, you know, you can't keep them that low. Like you say, that race to the bottom, where does that end? It's scary.
So the two quadrants we've been talking about are empowerment and just payments. And again, these are two quadrants of the impact wheel that is at the core of the book, Lead Like a Genius, How to Outgrow the Competition and Transform Our World. Our guest today is Melanie van de Velde, and the author of Lead Like a Genius. And so I'm looking at the time we have left, and there is no way we're going to get with any level of justice to the other two quadrants, planet, health and well-being, as well as good and bad profit, which you have a lot to say about. So I think I might leave those other two quadrants in terms of the things that we're thinking about, the questions that we ask, to the reader, listener, to get a copy of the book and to start asking those questions and think about. And what is the impact of your work on the planet and how your business is affecting and doing there? And then health and well-being, again, customers and employees, communities that you're part of, all of those elements. That said, Melanie, I do want to get to good and bad profit, but before we do, and I think that might be where we need to end, but before we do, can you tell us, for people who want to learn more, connect with you, find the book, learn more about all of this, there's so much here, where should they go?
Yeah, so people can, if they're interested in the book, they can buy it on Amazon or lulu.com, which is a sustainable B Corp, bookshops, or via my website, which is bigtreeglobal.net, and they get a 15% discount if they buy it on via my website. On my website, they can find more information also on other things we have, for example, a trip to Amsterdam for 2 days. People that might want to come visit Amsterdam, one of the most sustainable cities in the world. But it's an amazing opportunity because we'll spend 2 days really reflecting indeed on kind of in some sessions around kind of your intrinsic purpose of you as a person, as a business leader. But we're also going to see some of the global best practices and really kind of, get the real insights into why are they leading, both kind of as a commercial benefit side or the competitive advantage that they're gaining, but also why are they so exceptional in terms of tackling these issues and then apply it really to your own context. So on my website, bigtreeglobal.net, you can find more information.
All right, fantastic. Well, listener, I hope that you will take advantage of both those opportunities on the website, as well as taking a look at Lead Like a Genius, How to Outgrow the Competition and Transform Our World. This is such important work and so much good practical thinking that Melanie has put together here for us. So in the time that we have left, Melanie, I would love for you to walk us through the difference between good and bad profit. When we're thinking about from a business standpoint, there's nothing wrong with profit, but there's good profit, there's bad profit, how we go about that. And these are acronyms, so I'll just set the stage for our listener.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, exactly. So we're kind of trained to think that, you know, making profit is always good. And if you really simplify profit, it's obviously increasing revenue and reducing costs. And there are certain costs that are really good and important to drive down, but others, like the ones we just spoke about, you know, certain supplier prices, for example, it's harmful. The same with using ingredients or materials or processes that are cheaper, but really harmful for the future of us on this planet. And the same on the other side, there is certain ways to increase revenue that is really virtuous. It's very important to have good products, good services. That's what we should be competing on. But there's another way of increasing revenue that is bad, which is, you know, if you think about, you know, light, for example, but many other sectors are like that. They're designed for obsolescence. So intentionally short duration of lifespan to increase revenue. And that is harmful. It's harmful for our planet. It's not adding any value for the customer either. And we see this build in obsolescence in many products. But maybe just a quick example there to make that more practical. So if we think about light, that was the first kind of cartel, the Phoebus cartel, where manufacturers came together and said, let's shorten the duration of light products so we can sell them more often, we can increase our revenue, we can increase our profits. And many buildings, many companies use a lot of light. And Schiphol went to their supplier, Philips, and said, we no longer want to buy light as in products anymore, but can you give us a contract for 3 years? And we call it light as a service, and we pay you a fixed rate. You're now responsible to replace any fixtures and fittings and also to pay the electricity bill. And that completely changed the incentive for Philips designers to create more durable fixtures and fittings, also products that were easier to replace in parts as opposed to the full product, and that were more energy efficient. So that reduced fixtures and fittings and all the waste that comes with that and all the unnecessary emissions that comes with that by 75%. Wow. And energy usage by 50%. So I think a brilliant example of, you know, just looking at inspirational examples of what can be done. So I think it's understanding the difference. That's, I think, how you get to that leading like a genius. So leading, you know, profit and the impact, the value you create for our world. It is ultimately coming down to that. It's understanding, yes, profits are really important, you know, to build a healthy business, a growing business, but there are certain ways in which, you know, it's really virtuous to do that, and other ways that we should try and eliminate. And if we all did that, yeah, then we can, you know, we can turn the plastics crisis around. We can change climate change and all the extreme weather events that have tripled. You know, we can eradicate poverty. We can reduce inequalities. We absolutely can. So that is quite something, I think.
Yeah, that is no small thing. Absolutely. Yeah. So combining that focus and asking ourselves that question about to drive the positive impact, and as we're looking at how we achieve more profit in ways that increase sustainability at the same time. I am, as we close, Melanie, I'm curious if you have a final thought. We have a number of listeners who they're not the owner of their business, and maybe they're not yet in a position to go start an endeavor of some kind, but they do care and they're listening and going, I really want to make a difference. I want to figure out how to incorporate these things. So maybe they're leading within a business. Maybe they're leading within a larger organization that isn't yet aligned in this way of thinking. What do you have a suggestion for that listener of how they can start to take some practical action in this direction?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot that you can do on an individual level. But I think if you want to make it part of the business where you're working, I think you can play a really powerful role. I know so many people that say, I want to switch my job because I want to work somewhere that is more sustainable. But imagine how much impact you can have by actually changing, you know, your current business. I think we need a lot more of that. And I think if you want to persuade, if you want to persuade the top of your organization, it can be really useful, I think, to come with the business case. You know, there's so much more material, so many more studies that highlight that actually this is good for business. If you do it the right way, I mean, a Deloitte study shows purpose-driven companies who do this well grow 3 times faster, you know, due to better customer loyalty, referral rates. There's a Kantar report that shows, you know, they're valued at plus 175%. 86% of millennials say they want to take a pay cut, you know, to work somewhere that's more. And obviously this will only, you know, increase when the younger people who care more about this stuff become a larger part of your customer base, of your, you know, your employees. So I think if you come maybe with a good, you can present, you know, you can present like, can I explore this? And then maybe also, you know, there will most likely be more people in where you're working who are interested in this. You could set up a task force. But then I love the interface story, you know, where Ray Anderson says, look, that's exactly what happened to him. And I've worked with companies where staff have gone to the chief executive and said, let's do something. And most of the time, I think they're like, well, I know this is important. So yeah, let's explore this, right? Set up that task force. Let's go and go down this route. But I think the more powerful thing then happens is like what Ray Anderson explains was he, you know, he thought, right, my customers are asking for it. I better start doing something. They got a task force together. But it was really when he started to see it for himself, the links between his business and the impact it had on the world, that how he calls it, you know, was his spare in the chest moment. And it's when he went down, you know, wholeheartedly and down this road with all the amazing kind of successes that they've had as a company and as a leader in sustainability. So yeah, it could be worth just trying to get leadership and people within the business to become more aware of the issues, the links, and yeah, and just, yeah, sometimes it's a gradual process, but yeah, it could actually be a big, you know, you could make a big change in direction also.
And it occurs to me, and part of, I think, the value of the impact wheel is there are so many different ways to take a first step and to ask that first question. You know, as we're negotiating this, can we pay attention to this factor and raise that question and the business case that goes with it? And a series of those and a group of people, as you said, find the others and the group of people asking, and now you're starting to create momentum.
Yes.
And as you said, it's nice. Yeah, I want to go work for that. But what if you can build that within?
Exactly.
I love that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is a great place to wrap up our conversation for today. Melanie van de Velde, the author of Lead Like a Genius, How to Outgrow the Competition and Transform Our World. Thank you so much for being a guest with us today on Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
A real pleasure. Thanks, David.
It's been our pleasure. And so, listener, encourage you. How can you ask the questions and start thinking so that you can lead like a genius and pursue the unity of those opposites, bringing together profit and impact on our world? We need your leadership. So be the leader you want your boss to be.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.